If you approach a creative project, whether it's making art or, say, producing a podcast, with the sole goal of making a lot of money, I can almost guarantee the project will suffer. Passion has to come first. You need to love what you're doing. You have to create something that actually resonates with you and not just chasing some kind of trend or trying to mimic what's already out there. To stand out, you need to be unique. When I started this podcast, I did it because I felt like there was no art podcast that was what I wanted to listen to. It just simply didn't exist. I wanted a show that was high quality, free of unnecessary fluff. You know, I don't want people rambling for an hour and a half. And I wanted it to focus squarely on the people who create art. I didn't want it focused on the business surrounding their art. I want to know more of why they paint. The things that inspire them, the things that have happened to them, that's what I wanted to hear about, and it just wasn't out there. My hope was that if I made a show that I genuinely was passionate about, others might enjoy it as well. With that in mind, let's turn to the story of an artist who understands firsthand the importance of creating something you believe in and finding others who believe in it as well. I'm your host, Jacob Johnson. This is the My Art is Real podcast, a narrative journey into the lives that shape art. Today's episode, Ben Frost, right after the break. This episode of the My Art is Real podcast is brought to you by you, the listener. This podcast would not be possible without you sharing this podcast with all your friends and family. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to take your support a step further, please head on over to myartisreal.com. There you can purchase limited edition art prints that I've created with various artist friends and previous podcast guests. When you purchase these prints, not only are you getting a limited edition print, but you're also supporting me and the artist directly. Thank you so much for listening. Back to the episode.
My name is Ben Frost, and I'm a pop art painter. I'm currently living in Melbourne, Australia.
And so actually, where in Australia was it that you were raised?
So I was born in Australia, up in Queensland, in a place called Mullaney, which is about an hour north of Brisbane. It's a regional kind of town. So kind of grew up in the country. But when I was old enough to get out of there, I got out as quick as I could. And I've been spending a lot of time overseas.
And was it really like the country, or just sort of, there just wasn't like, and it was an area where there wasn't much going on, wasn't much interesting?
I think as far as growing up, anywhere that you live in Australia feels a little bit like you're a long way from everything. I think that's one of the main things a lot of Australian artists seem to find, is that because we are so far away from all the media and the things that we see on the television and the internet, there's a real strong sense of needing to get out, travel. So in my travels, I've noticed how many Australians are going off overseas as soon as they're old enough.
If you regularly listen to this podcast, you probably already know that I grew up in the country where there just wasn't much going on. One of the biggest challenges of living out there was you have this heavy dependence on cars to get anywhere you need to be. And of course, that's really hard to do when you're a kid and you can't drive and you can't just walk over to your buddy's house.
I think living in the country is often annoying because there's such a distance to get to your friends. You sort of have to make your own fun. Of course, you know, when you're living in the city, you know, you might have a friend who lives on the next street over from you. But, you know, having to get your parents to drive you anywhere was always a hassle. Particularly too, like there was no footpaths or anywhere you could like skateboard, or even riding a bike was sometimes hard because there wasn't necessarily places to do things like that.
Making your own fun is something I know all too well. Like that one summer when I spent practically every day doing flips on a trampoline and watching videos of other people doing flips on trampolines. Or there was a time where we found this giant plastic tube and we climbed inside and just would roll it down the hill for fun. Yeah, it turns out it's a total blast. And so what sort of stuff were you getting into when you were growing up?
I suppose my generation sort of had the first series of computers. So I remember having a Commodore 64, which was just such an old computer now. But yeah, I was really into computer games. And I suppose from a young age, I started working with my parents, who were both shopkeepers. I think even from the age of 11 or 12, I would be working in the shop with them, helping them out, which I think is something that has pushed on further into what I'm doing now and fed my career from there.
And the shop that your parents ran, what was it?
They had a whole bunch of different retail stores over the years. The main one was a gift shop. So from a young age, you know, they would be buying certain gifts and they would be making them as well. So from a young age, that really engendered in me this idea of creating products for exhibition or to show, you know, like a shop, you get products, you put them out, you put prices on them, you kind of invite the people in to look at it. So in the same way, a shop is like an exhibition in a way. It's just that it's been changed around a little bit.
In Ben's comparison of running a gift shop, making and selling different items, to creating and presenting works in a gallery is one I often use when talking to non-art collectors about why people actually buy paintings. I have plenty of family members who will hang little decorative knickknacks and things around their house because it just brings them joy and makes them happy, but they still, for some reason, do not see the understanding of buying paintings and buying art. But here's the thing. It doesn't have to be deep or profound. Sometimes it's simply about finding a piece that makes you smile. And when you see it hanging in your home each and every day, it has this power to brighten your life in the most simplest, most meaningful ways. As Ben got older, he started to lean even more into drawing, and art soon became what he was known for.
I think it's when you get to high school, when you start getting in your teens, that everybody usually finds something that would define them as their character. And so I kind of moved into that person who read comic books and would be drawing from the comic books. It's funny, actually, some of my earliest memories of drawing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, drawing their faces and caricature of them because they're quite easy to draw. And then as a young boy, you'd be drawing the musculature and getting into an anatomy. But now that I've got kids, it's just weird that my kids are now into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. This is a really strange circular loop.
Yeah, I don't think the Ninja Turtles could ever go out of style. I mean, come on, it's fighting turtles who just love pizza. It doesn't get any cooler than that. It didn't take long for him to realize his potential in art. And soon he started to see it as something worth pursuing, not just as a hobby, but as a serious path into adulthood.
Yeah, in high school, I would do a lot of drawing. I did the cover of the graduation yearbook. From there, I just felt like I was tapped on the shoulder to be like, okay, you're going to go ahead and be an artist. Leaving high school, I just went straight into that and went to university. And then from university, went straight into doing exhibitions. And I've just been running, doing that since then.
Today, Ben's work has been widely recognized and has been exhibited around the world. But his journey began, just like everyone else's, with a dream and a struggle to find his footing.
I think in the beginning, things can be very scary. It's very strange now to look back at or to remember just how difficult it was for those first, you know, 10, 15 years even, or 10 years. And now to look at me being able to actually have a source of income that is like a normal job. Because I think as an artist, a young artist, you've always got this chip on your shoulder that when someone asks you what you do and you say, oh, I'm an artist, there's always this sense from other people that that's not really a real job. So you have this chip on your shoulder for such a long time. And then when you start getting more successful and actually making it, you know, a good income, it's like you're becoming an adult, but at such an older time in your life. You know, the first 10, 15 years, you'd look around at other friends and they would have real jobs and they'd be the ones who'd have a car and they'd be putting a down payment on a house and doing all these serious adult things. Yeah, I think it becomes a scary proposition to decide to be an artist and to try and push that as the thing that you do full time.
Even with that fear, there's always a glimpse of hope that maybe, just maybe, you'll break through into the art world and create something that resonates with others. So Ben did the only thing he could do, which was keep pushing forward. Did you feel a ton of confidence that it would work out? Or how did you feel during that time in college?
I was very excited about the idea of being an artist. I didn't really know what kind of artist I would be in the early stages, but you know, reading magazines about exhibitions that were happening in New York or in Los Angeles or London, you know, it was just so exciting. So I felt as if that's what I wanted to do. I really needed to go and exhibit overseas, and even just the idea of having like an advertisement for your exhibition in a magazine was like just the greatest idea in the world. Yeah, I just felt that's the world I wanted to be in, and I just had to do whatever I could to get to that.
An artist's style can evolve a lot over the years, sometimes even shifting to completely different mediums. Ben, now known for his paintings, actually started out creating some art that was wildly different.
I had aspirations to be quite avant-garde, and I was doing performance art pieces, lots of strange things, nude performances covered in yellow paint, injecting drugs, things where I'd talk to the sun. They're really trying to push the boundaries of what was acceptable. And the whole concept of painting to me was just too traditional and too old school. But when I left university, I tried to push on with that, and that didn't really work out. So I tried my hand at painting, which I had been good at school.
Luckily, he made the move back to painting, and that's when he started to find a lot more success in that medium.
And some of the first paintings that I did, I put them in an art prize, and I won this art prize called the Churchy, and I won that 2 years in a row. And that really established me then to push on to doing painting. And I was just happened to be quite lucky. I was making paintings that were trying to be as untraditional as possible. You know, I was using rollers and masking tape and paint pens, and I would change the edges of the actual canvas or the boards I was making so they had curved edges. So it's kind of really trying to reinterpret the concept of painting and to do it in a non-traditional way that didn't have any finger marks or you could see that it had any evidence that someone had actually painted it. So that style was quite good. End of the 90s, where we were moving towards a computer future where sort of the internet had just begun. And so everything had this kind of modular look to it.
This phase of Ben's life was in the late 90s and early 2000s. It's when street art was taking over the world by storm. And that was a storm that Ben was more than ready to chase.
But yeah, then I moved down to Melbourne and people began making stencils and doing stuff on the street, which sort of brought about by the rise of Banksy. And when Banksy was discovered, or when people saw Banksy, it was just this revelation of the idea of making a stencil and putting it on the street was just so mind-blowing. So I think a lot of that also feeds back to technology and the use of computers at that time. Being able to make vectors was a really early thing that I think really influenced art in general.
Being in Australia, so far away from other major art capitals of the world like New York and LA and Paris, Ben felt like he was just sort of missing out.
I think for an Australian, there's this real sense of missing out and not sort of participating as much as what you see other artists or other people doing, the communities that you can see in certain places in Europe and America. For me, there was this real sense of needing to get over to be a part of that. And, you know, another part of that is you've got to sort of have enough money to do that. So it took a while for me to get to a point where I was, I felt as if I was ready to do that and, you know, could even afford a plane ticket.
One day, he finally made the leap, and he hopped on a plane ready to leave Australia.
As soon as I could, I moved. We moved down to Melbourne, which is where I'm living now. And then I went over to Japan. And for me, going to Japan was the most opposite place you could go. It was a place where people don't speak English. Just the intensity of life there, living in Tokyo, you know, it was just the most crazy place you could go to.
He was able to move to Tokyo and have a job through a program which required him to teach English.
So in Tokyo at the time, they had a conversational English school. And there would be one at pretty much every train station all throughout Tokyo. And Japanese people would drop in at their lunch break, or they'd have lessons, and it was just conversational. So you'd be in a room with three other students, and you would just pretty much talk to them, going through a basic lesson plan. And, you know, I think I did that like three or four hours a day. That gave me enough money to live. And, you know, I started a band over there. You know, I really threw myself into it. But yeah, it was a great option for a young person to get out and see the world and get a job doing it.
He did what most people never could do, and he took that leap and found himself living in a place unlike anything he had ever experienced before. But the art scene in Japan was much different from what he had known.
My idea was to go over to Japan and continue doing stuff on the streets over there. But when I arrived, it became pretty obvious that the concept of street art was a lot different in the way that people relate to their surroundings, such that in Melbourne, you know, everything's covered in tags because there's a lot more of a disrespect for the city. But Japan essentially is such a tidy place, especially then. I've noticed that now it's, you know, there's a lot of graffiti and street art happening in Japan. But yeah, it was a kind of funny scenario to go to a place where everyone lived like such a tighter community, such that everyone was more respectful of their environment. Yeah, I didn't really do any street art there. I was working for magazines as well as an illustrator. So that was something that I spent a lot of time doing. And it was something that you can do, you know, a job that you can just be sending things in. So it wasn't as if I had to be in Australia to work for an Australian magazine.
Despite Tokyo's lack of a street art scene and the challenges of finding adequate space for a proper studio, Japan proved to be brimming with inspiration for a young artist like Ben.
I suppose as a solo traveler and being in a new country where I had a job and a house or an apartment, I had an opportunity to, you know, go around Tokyo. Places like Harajuku was just such an alien world for a young person. I suppose it was just a playground. And because there was a lot of other English teachers who were all in the same situation, the same similar age, and a lot of them were creative, and, you know, we'd start bands and we did exhibitions. I suppose it's when you put yourself in those situations that things are so different, is that you learn new ways of applying yourself. As an artist trying to make art in Japan, it's a different kind of art because the galleries are a lot smaller, and then the studios are a lot smaller, so you don't necessarily make art that's super big because there's sort of nowhere to display it. And if someone wants to buy it, they've got nowhere to put it at home. So there's a real focus on design. And for me as a pop artist, going into a 7-Eleven or any convenience store in Japan was like a mecca because, you know, everything's got anime or, you know, hentai, you know, the colors, the logos as well, because it's in a different language. Kind of makes the object banal or meaningless. The idea of text and someone trying to sell you something, kind of a banal exercise in a way. As long as something's brightly colored and has a funny character on it, it becomes appealing, whatever the thing is, you know. So I think that really helped inform me after I'd left Japan, because I couldn't really paint in Japan. So it was more about absorbing all of this color and all of this hyper happiness that was just constantly thrown on you all the time. Absorbing that and then leaving, coming back to Australia and putting that into my paintings. And I think that kind of really pushed me into a style that I wouldn't have been able to find unless I had gone to Japan and absorbed all that.
He spent about 2 years in Japan, soaking up all the inspiration he could. During this time, the internet was becoming a much bigger deal. For me, growing up in the countryside with no real art scene around me, the internet was my gateway into it all. I watched the Banksy documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop one day, which for me was like falling down a rabbit hole. One that led me to discover more and more artists and more styles, and eventually to creating the My Art Is Real Instagram page, which just started as a simple place for me to share the work I was finding. Ben often talks about growing up in Australia and the isolating feeling of being so far from the action. from the vibrant art communities of places like New York. Even though the internet was still in its early days of connecting people, Ben immediately saw its potential, so he started using it to link up with artists across the globe.
Yeah, I for a while there, I thought maybe I would spend a lot more time in Japan. It felt as if it was one big crazy holiday, really. And so I felt like I needed to get back into a studio and really get painting again. I suppose my style of art at that time started to fit in well with the pop surrealism movement that was coming up through Juxtapoz, early Juxtapoz, before Juxtapoz went into more street art. And as I was saying, the internet was a different place back then. There was a lot less people on the internet, so that I remember typing in pop artists, and the only other pop artist I could find on a search engine back then was Ron English, you know, other than, you know, people from the 60s. So there was a real explosion of artists and artists making websites and getting their stuff being seen. And so the community was quite small. And I was lucky enough that, you know, I started speaking with a lot of artists from around the world. And so they invited me to be in these bigger exhibitions that, you know, it was really the start of a global community. Previous to that, you could only ever find out about what was happening in the art world through magazines.
Not only was having a website such a big advantage back then, but it was also much harder to create one. Today, with platforms like WordPress and other website builders, you can have a site up and running in about an hour or so, and it looks pretty decent. But back then, it took a lot more work.
I think the idea of the website was just that when you went online, and there was such creativity to a lot of websites, so much so that being able to see someone else's portfolio of an artist in Sweden or wherever it was, and the website was so well built, it just put that artist on a pedestal way above any other kind of artist. So luckily I had friends who could do coding and could make me a website. So that became a priority. I think the first website I had was maybe 1999.
The website really paid off when Ben started receiving requests to exhibit his works around the world. One of the big shows that helped his career was a group show he was invited to participate in San Francisco.
When I did that first San Francisco group show, the artists who put it on were from Amsterdam, and they had invited like Ron English and Mark Mothersbaugh, and there was even an ad in Juxtapoz for it, which at the time was like, whoa. Yeah, I think the community was a lot tighter then, such that, you know, there were only 50 names that you could choose from of artists around the world who are doing a similar style, but it just kept exponentially growing. And now, you know, this entire forum is just filled with artists. So I think for me, I was just in a good position at the right time. So I think a lot of it's to do with luck and just where you've been positioned.
Ben was absolutely relentless in his pursuit of becoming a full-time artist. Put his work out there as much as possible, paying attention to what people liked, what people didn't, and of course, seeing the potential of the internet before most others did. While luck does definitely play a role in life, Ben knew he had to set himself up for success, and he was definitely doing that. When you were doing more of these international shows going all over the world, how did that feel at the time?
I think when I first was participating in shows like that, it was just amazing because you could just meet these people, and they were, you know, exciting and doing things that you just wouldn't be able to see at home. When I realized how easy it was to get a plane ticket somewhere and go to have an exhibition with people, and, you know, the camaraderie of, you know, I still talk to those artists that I met 20 years ago, you know, just realizing that you can find a community and you don't have to find it at home. You can go overseas. And once I found the confidence to know that I could do it, I just kept replicating that, and I've been doing most of my exhibitions now overseas over the last 20 years.
And so it began. Ben's work was popping up in cities and countries all across the world. With his use of pop culture references and often edgy, eye-catching graphics, he was leaving a lasting impression on anyone who happened to glance at one of his pieces.
I think when you come up with a style that is unique, that people latch onto, you know, it's just such a buzz. It's like taking a drug. It's like you've found a, it's like you're mining and you found a vein of gold in the earth. And so once you find that vein with your little pickaxe, you know, you just want to keep digging and digging and digging and exploring that. I suppose in that metaphor, it's the only downside is you can only dig out that mine for so long before you've got to go and find another mine.
And throughout all of this, he also played a key role in helping build up the art community in his home country of Australia.
I suppose every artist is trying to be different, though. You know, I know that when I came back from Japan, I moved to Sydney. Street art really was starting to really pick up. That was the buzzword. Everyone wanted street art. And at that time, there was nowhere to sort of sell, to make money out of being a street artist. And there were a lot of street artists in Sydney. So I was making prints of my work, and that was working really well. That was the beginning of prints. Like when you look at an artist like Banksy, you know, he's predominantly known not only for his things he does on the street, but the prints that he sells. And so there's this massive boom of prints. And so I started a print company with a lot of the artists that were around me who didn't really have any way of selling their work. So that company was called Stupid Crap. So Stupid Crap with a K. And it was my way of having a platform or a forum where we could start a community of artists making a similar style and commodify it so that we could sort of generate an income.
Around the time that COVID-19 hit, Ben was also becoming a father. With travel restrictions and the added responsibilities at home, he found himself spending more time in Australia. But because he had already built such a strong community through his other exhibitions, through online, he no longer felt that pressure to constantly be doing shows in other cities to make things work. I mean, Ben's style of art is straight up pop art, but one unique twist, one that brings a raw, in-your-face feeling to his works while also adding plenty of layers of meaning, is his use of drug packages as his canvas. So tell me how the iconic works of medicine boxes came about.
So the works on the medicine boxes, I think at the time I was making these big pop art mashup paintings where I would be painting logos and painting characters interacting in these big paintings. And it became apparent that rather than actually painting like a Coca-Cola logo or any kind of brand, I could find the actual packaging that had the logo on it and then just paint onto that packaging. I think at the time I was living above an Asian grocery store and we shared the same garbage area. And so when I'd be out there throwing my rubbish out, I'd be seeing the disused cardboard boxes that they were throwing out. And because it was an Asian grocery store and they had all these really interesting packaging, I started taking some of that back into my studio and using that as my canvas. It just made sense that the idea of my artwork was about using imagery that I was finding. You know, it was appropriation art. So I'd be using Mickey Mouse and I'd be using things that I was finding on the internet or in magazines. It made sense then to continue on that I'd be finding rubbish. And I remember seeing there was a Xanax cardboard box that was in the gutter. And I picked it up and I was like, wow, this would be a good idea to paint onto this. But if you actually look at a lot of the drug packages, they're quite nicely designed. And for certain packages, like Zoloft, you know, they'll have the branding and the graphic design on one side, and they'll just have this beautifully open area that I've got somewhere to paint onto. So that exploration of finding packages and trying to fit characters onto them to create new meanings and new ideas has been super rewarding.
And this series has become an almost collaboration between his collectors and himself.
These days, I get people who send me packaging from all around the world. And I know for them, I can sense the feeling of expression that they can have because they're making use of the objects of what their condition is. You know, like if someone has depression or whatever ailment that they're taking these drugs for, by sending them to me and for me to make art with them, it's kind of like a therapeutic process such that there's meaning behind their involvement with the whole medication situation. But it's been a good avenue for me because you don't really think about branding or advertising on with drug packages. When you think of how something's advertised, you instantly think of cereal boxes or soft drink Coca-Cola, you know. But there is a whole ecosystem within pharmaceuticals that is, you know, still a process of branding and an exercise in color, and they've got their own logos. So, you know, it's been really interesting for me then to explore other things, you know, painted onto board games, painted onto World War II stamps, you know, and McDonald's fry packages. You know, I've painted a million of those things. But these are things that are in our environment all the time. So for me, it's like recycling in a way, and it's like finding this rubbish and repurposing it into something that then becomes something you hang on your wall. So it's an interesting loop there.
The way that people react to your work when they see it, what's that like for you?
I get a lot of happiness from the reaction to my work, and I think that's why I am a pop artist. So by nature of the term pop, it aims to be popular. When I applied myself to question, okay, well, what is a painting? What is this thing that you're making? Is it to be sold, or is it to be hung in a gallery just to be looked at? So I think for me, applying myself into the idea of making an object that is as most pleasing as possible, that not only is beautiful to look at or engaging to look at, but something that someone wants to actually buy. So there's this level of awareness and testing a market to see what people are enjoying or not enjoying. So yeah, I think everyone has a different perspective on why they make an artwork. I think for me, a big part of it is trying to understand what a viewer wants to see. You know, I get a lot of enjoyment for when I make things that I can see that, you know, have an appealing nature to them, that also has a meaning to it. You know, it's not just surface level. There's more within that to talk about.
You know, you've been an artist for so long at this point. When you sit and you think, oh, I actually did it. I'm a full-time artist now. I mean, how does that feel for you?
Yeah, it's a very strange feeling. Having spent most of your life as an artist, you know, really struggling, and then to be lucky enough to make some money out of it. Yeah, I don't know. It's a difficult question.
What makes Ben's story so interesting to me is how, like myself, he comes from practically the middle of nowhere. But through the use of the internet, he was able to carve out a path for himself in his own unique way. I hope that by sharing his story here today, it can serve as a bridge for others to realize just how vastly different each of our paths can be. But that relentlessness and passion for what you're doing, if you keep that, you can find that path that's right for you. As we close out 2024, this marks the final episode of the year. And I wanted to take a moment to reflect on how special these 2 years of making this podcast has been for me. When I started this podcast, I was terrified. I was worried my voice wouldn't sound right. I was worried no one would listen. I was scared to be vulnerable. But as I sat down to tell these artist stories, I learned so much from each and every one of them. I learned that it's okay to be different, and having a unique voice is a strength. And it's okay to be honest and vulnerable, especially when you live in a world this field is as much fake as we are today. When episode 1 dropped in 2022, I had about 30 listeners within the first couple of days, and I was completely over the moon. Now it's been 2 years relentlessly editing and producing. And now we've reached thousands of listeners each month, and it still blows my mind. And to think that we're already past episode 50, headed on our way to episode 100, I mean, it happened in the blink of an eye, and I just can't wait to see what next year is going to hold and where we're going to go from here. Thank you to every single one of you who listens. I know I say that every episode, but it's a true blessing to have all of you listen to my show and appreciate the work I'm putting in and appreciate the stories I'm telling and when I get emails and messages from all of you saying how inspired you are by certain episodes, that like means the world to me and is what keeps me going. So thank you for listening. I hope you all have an amazing new year. And I can't wait to see where we all head in 2025.